Grazie America. News from the Sister Republic. A University of St. Gallen podcast by Claudia Brühwiler. Grazie miteinander and welcome to a new episode of Views from the Sister Republic. What it's going to be about? Well, wait, don't tell me. We'll let the fresh air in, have all things considered, and talk about this American life. Yeah, that was a bit tacky, but I couldn't resist. These are all titles of some of the most iconic and most popular shows of NPR, America's National Public Radio. In contrast to many European public broadcasting corporations, US public TV and radio are relatively young, dating back to the 1970s. To compare, Swiss Broadcasting Corporation was founded in 1931, and the grand old dame, British Broadcasting Corporation BBC, was founded more than 100 years ago. So the US is really late to the public media game. And what's more is that the system is much more complicated and decentralized than in most European countries. Moreover, federal funding for public media flows through the congressionally chartered Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which is a non-profit organization, so it's not even an administrative unit. All very different, all very complicated, but all that should have served for public media not to become a political punching ball. That didn't really work out that well. Since the inception, since the beginning of public media, it has always been politically controversial. And on May 1st this year, the White House issued an executive order to, I quote, end taxpayer subsidization of biased media. Sounds strange to our ears, but we have someone here who can explain it all to us. To discuss the role of public media in the United States and why it is so much more controversial than in most European countries, I'm honored to be joined by none other than NPR CEO Catherine Marr. Welcome to Switzerland and welcome to Grazie America, Catherine.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
We are recording this episode at the occasion of St. Gallen Symposium, where Catherine was awarded the Monika and Wolfgang Schürer Award for promoting intergenerational dialogue. Congratulations on that award. One of many, I think.
Thank you. It was a tremendous honor.
Prior to becoming CEO of NPR, you were, among other things, the CEO of Wikimedia Foundation, but you also gained foreign policy experience. So you actually had your professional start in the foreign policy area. What then led you to the world of media?
Well, I actually see my journey as being a continuation of my experience in foreign policy. I studied in the Middle East. I received my degree in Middle Eastern studies. I was very interested in the time at the role of technology in changing the way that people were in accessing information and communicating with the world. I went and worked for an international development with UNICEF, and from there continued to work on sort of these issues of democracy, human rights, and access to information, starting in democracy and governance organizations and working my way through to Wikipedia. And at the time I was at Wikipedia, which was a very global organization, still has many foreign policy implications for what we do, I became aware of how important the overall information ecosystem is and how important public media is to that. Now, I'd always listened to public media as a young person growing up. I was an avid reader of the news. But in working with information day in and day out, it felt very important to me to spend some time actually supporting the news and information ecosystem through more direct work. So we still have a very large international desk with correspondents all over the world. So I still feel connected in some ways to my starting point. But I think my career has followed what feels the most important at the moment for the work that I do and the needs that exist.
How many journalists work for NPR?
We have about 600 journalists who work for NPR directly. And then in the broader public radio network in the United States, there are an additional 3,000.
Now, you were already saying at the public radio network.
I know, it's so confusing.
Really. I read that NPR consists of member organizations that operate, and now maybe some Swiss listeners need to take a seat, 1,024 public radio stations across the United States. So how does this really work? So to what extent is NPR one radio station? How do you mix programming, et cetera? How does it all work?
So since you started by talking a little bit about the history and when we were founded in the NPR was founded in 1970, it's worth noting that there are public radio stations in the United States that are more than 100 years old. So New York is one example of that. And the reason I mention that is because in the late 1960s, public media organizations got together and said, we need a national news organization. We can report on our local communities, we can report on our cities and our states, but to cover the international news or the international news, that requires capacity we don't have. And that was what led to the creation of NPR. It's a membership organization. So all of our stations belong to the membership of NPR, and they broadcast NPR's news coverage, our morning show and our evening show. Morning Edition and All Things Considered are the most listened to and most important parts of our work. But those stations also produce local programming. They produce shows that are unique to them, call-in shows, public affairs shows, cooking shows, sports shows, things that resonate with the community that they serve. Music is a really big one because in the U.S., musical regionality is a really big part of our culture.
But there are also like these staple shows aside from Morning Edition and All Things Considered. So is it up to the member stations whether they use, for instance, All Things Considered is part of the shows anyway.
But for example, Fresh Air.
Yeah. Yes. Or in the past, it was the Diane Rame show that I really enjoyed listening to, or my absolute favorite, Car Talk. I felt that was heard everywhere.
Not really about cars.
I think it was the best source to learn everything about the US. But so do these member stations choose what they run?
They do. And that's, I think, part of how public radio is so relevant in a country that is so large and frankly, very diverse, right? The West and the South are different from the North, East and the, you know, California and the Great Plains. So individual stations have individual programming, and they, when you're a member station of NPR, you do run Morning Edition and All Things Considered. You also probably run our, what we call newscast, which is our top of the hour, every hour news programming that's just the news of the world or the news of the country. Beyond that, it's totally up to them. They can say, we want to listen to Fresh Air six times a week, or we don't want to listen to Fresh Air at all. Or many stations produce their own programming, and then even they might sell that to other stations. So you mentioned Fresh Air. Fresh Air is produced by our Philadelphia station. We distribute it as NPR. We co-produce and distribute it. But stations like the Car Talk actually came out of Boston, similar sort of
very audibly Boston,
very, very Boston. Yes. And so we're also scouts for great public radio shows that come out from around the country. I should also say we as NPR are not the only, making it even more complicated, we're not the only producers of public radio. So two other popular shows, which would include Marketplace, which is a economics show that's produced by American Public Media. And then you had, for a very long time, Prairie Home Companion.
Oh, yeah.
Another very popular one, also produced by American Public Media. So it's much more of a market for public media than I think many people realize, which is why it is so complicated. It's a very complicated system.
But governance-wise, are there like annual meetings or quarter-annual meetings where all the heads of these local and regional stations come together and tell each other what kind of programming, well, they might discourage from being continuously produced? Is what level of exchange is there?
There's quite a lot of exchange. In fact, when I go back home tomorrow, one of the reasons I have to get home is because next week we have our annual, what we call a fly-in, which means that all of the heads of stations or sort of senior executives from the stations are coming to NPR headquarters, and we will talk about everything from the future of our technology platforms to our show programming to the current political environment around funding. And that is really sort of a strategic and operational meeting that I think that this may actually be more familiar to your audiences. We also have governance meetings where essentially we pull together the consortium of members and they vote on governance bylaws issues, things along those lines. We have open quarterly board meetings in order to be able to present on the finances and operations to all of our members and to the public. I think that that's a little more in keeping with many of the European models of governance. And so we are an outlier even in the United States with how cooperative and collaborative our operations are.
Do you have any collaboration with PBS or is that completely separate?
It is separate and not, is how I would say it. So PBS is the television broadcaster, or a different way I think to think about it in today is really video, video documentaries. They have a news show that is a more traditional sort of television news show. We are audio, but it's not just radio. Of course, we do podcasts. Increasingly, we also do video that accompanies those podcasts or those shows. We do social media. We do digital media. I think the biggest differentiation is less about our medium and more that NPR produces content directly. We have a newsroom and PBS acquires content. And so they have stations that produce shows like Antiques Roadshow, or they'll acquire shows like Masterpiece Theater. PBS was famously the home of Downton Abbey for a very long time
and
in the U.S.
a lot of other British shows.
Many British shows, yes, very popular. And then it has a flagship news program called NewsHour. Some stations broadcast NewsHour because it's a very well-respected news show. So there's a little bit of intersection. We consider ourselves sister organizations with common missions, but slightly different programming perspectives.
And I saw one difference is to what extent you rely on federal funding for your budget. So I saw PBS gets 15% through federal funding.
You got 16%, yeah.
And you only 1%. So how does your funding model actually function? Because 1% sounds like nothing.
Yes. So the overall value of the funding that comes from the U.S. Congress to public media is shockingly low to a European's ears. Mm-hmm. It would be about $535 million per year. 75% of that goes to television and 25% of that goes to radio. So we receive all of radio across the entire country, receives $121 million in funding, and about $100 million of that goes directly to stations. So the remaining 20-ish million dollars goes to a couple different things. It goes to acquiring music rights so that you can listen to music stations or music can play on the air. It goes to some of the core infrastructure, technical infrastructure, like how we run the websites for all of the network. And it goes to supporting new shows and programs. So if you have an interest in launching a show, you can apply for funding to the you can apply to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and you might get a grant to go launch a new show. NPR receives 1% of its funding through that grant process. And it has historically been for our international coverage, for conflict reporting. So for the war in Ukraine, for Gaza and Israel recently, and then for our election coverage, because the elections in the United States are an enormous operation, but they also come about for the presidential only every 4 years. So you need to be able to scale up and scale down. Yeah. And that's what that grant supports.
And how do you get the rest of your operation funding covered?
Yeah.
I mean, everyone who has heard NPR knows there are all these sponsorships. Yes. It's also for our European ear a bit strange when you hear sponsored by Edutopia. But I mean, that can't be most of it, or is it?
It's complicated, like everything. Okay, so NPR's budget is about $300 million a year. So $3 million, roughly, is from these grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. About $100 million is from the membership fees that stations pay. And so we have 246 members. For a music station that airs less of our news coverage, those fees are going to be smaller. For a major station with a very large audience that airs a lot of our coverage, those fees are going to be larger. They it allows them access to the programs to be able to distribute them, but also other services as well. We represent them in front of Congress. We provide them with some of the technical infrastructure to operate their websites. We also operate the satellite distribution system for all public media audio across the country. And so being a member comes with a lot of benefits as well as, you know, sort of a transaction as a sort. That's that $100 million in fees. And then the underwriting budget is actually about $100 million. And so the majority of that's actually from the podcast side, not the radio side.
Okay.
Which is interesting. But that underwriting that you hear, it might sound strange to a European ear, but it compared to American advertisements, it's very subdued. You know, it's sort of this is brought to you by in the name of the company versus what we always joke in the US is like Sunday, come down to the mountain, you know, monster truck rally, you know, or, you know, cars are on sale this Memorial Day only, right? So it's a very, very different audio. Sorry to do that to your listeners, but it's a very different thing. And we are subject to FCC, which is a Federal Communication Commission guidelines about non-commercial educational stations, about what we can accept in terms of underwriting. We can't make claims about a product. You know, we can only say, you know, such and such is a bank and offers financial services, things along those lines. And then the last bit of our funding comes from, as PBS would say, viewers like you or listeners like you. Yes. And so
you get a tote bag.
You get a tote bag. Exactly. And so I know the tote bag is so famous. We have both individual and philanthropic, so foundation donations that come in to NPR. And then we have some assorted investment revenue from our foundation, which is our endowment that helps sort of be a resource to the organization over time.
So how important is that 1% coming from Congress anyway? Because that's now what's on the line. Mm-hmm. We have the executive order that said, let's slash that. But, it's actually not legal for the president to just slash the 1% funding because it goes through this strange construct, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And so once the money is earmarked this way, it can't be taken away. But how important is it anyway?
So if your listeners are still with us through all of this bureaucratic explanation, thank you.
You know,
thank
you so much. It's really fascinating.
It is. It's so complex. So the Corporation for Public Broadcasting was established with the goal of insulating public media from political interference, as you said in the introduction. And what you see with the Corporation for Public Broadcasting is the money that goes into the federal public broadcasting systems is appropriated 2 years in advance. And the reason for that is to give us further protections from the political moment of the day. So right now, as Congress is evaluating the budget for this coming fiscal year, 2026, we are actually talking about 2028 in public media. What the president has done two things. He has asked first that Congress rescind all of the funding that has already been appropriated for 2026 and 2027. So we have 2 years of budget in the bank. He's asking to take that back. There are arguments about why he can or can't do that. The next set of questions is he has also put forward an executive order saying no funding to NPR or PBS. The way that public media works, and to answer your question about whether it's important, I mentioned that $100 million goes to our stations around the country. $88 million of that goes to NPR stations. Mm. There are many public media stations that are not NPR members, local community stations. That funding is essential for how they operate. And so when I am visiting a station in, say, rural North Carolina or in the Great Plains in the Midwest, the infrastructure that is required to broadcast in mountainous terrain across very large distances is quite resource intensive. And so that federal funding for those small stations goes very much into that infrastructure, broadcast towers and the like, the engineers to maintain it. That's what allows us to cover 99.7% of the country. In many parts of the US, still, you don't have access to high speed broadband. You don't necessarily have access to universal mobile network service. Alaska is a great example where the local stations, the percentage of their funding that comes from the federal government is somewhere over 30%. So it's actually quite significant. If that federal funding goes away, those local stations are going to have a really hard time maintaining infrastructure, employing reporters, or purchasing or staying a member of NPR. And so the question is, well, why does that matter? NPR programming is about 25% of what a station airs over the course of a day, but it's about 50% of their listening. And the vast majority of donations come in during NPR's morning and afternoon shows to the local stations, because that's the peak of listening for the station. Without that programming, stations will not be able to replace that national and international news that accompanies their local news. And so people come not just for local, not just for national, they come for the whole mix. And so we're a very symbiotic relationship between the local station's news and our national news. And it's very important to the economic health of the station. So if the funding goes away, it'll be hard for those stations to operate. It will impact their ability to be members of NPR, which also impacts our operational budget, because it will reduce the resources we have to do news gathering. And it will be damaging to listenership for the stations, which can have sort of a recurring negative cycle for their economics overall. Again, complex system.
Yeah, totally. And I mean, the way you are describing it, one gets the sense that who will suffer the most are people who are the most remote from other networks and other ways of accessing world news, etc. I mean, there's always the internet, etc. But radio is very pervasive.
And again, it's often hard to think. I often have this conversation with members of Congress. Sitting in D.C., it's very easy to forget that you drive an hour outside of Washington, D.C., and you are in places that do not have cell phone service. Even leaving my house to go to the office, I lose cell phone service along the way.
Yeah, that's true. I've experienced interesting cell phone gaps in the U.S.
Let alone broadband access. High-speed broadband just is not a thing in many parts of the country. So the internet, yes, is a great resource, and we know that there's lots of news, but also, this idea that it's available to everyone is not true. And then when it goes down, when there's a major disaster, a storm, which happens all the time, when I in the hometown that I'm from, power would go out for a week at a time following a major storm. That's when radio is absolutely essential. And we saw this in the aftermath of this really big hurricane, Hurricane Helene, that did enormous damage to North Carolina. And the water was out for 54 days.
Wow. Yeah.
And the radio in that time was one of the only resources that town had to say, well, where can I get clean water? Where can I get food? You know, where can I go in town where I might be able to get a signal to let my relatives know that I'm okay? And that was our local public radio station, Blue Ridge Public Radio, that was doing all that work.
And in my thinking and in my experience, radio is also something very communal, whereas the internet, we tend to consume on our own, or it's something that's very private. Also, podcast listening tends to be something rather private and individual, whereas listening to the radio news is something that you might do when you're getting your hair cut, when you're with your family, etc. But who is your community? Who is the community of NPR listeners? Because the stereotype says those are the more urban, the college class, people who are debating whether they should go from vegetarian to vegan. So who is the NPR listener, really?
The stereotype of an NPR listener is a college professor with leather patches on their elbows who probably has a Subaru that is covered in dog hair and carries a tote bag. But that's not actually who the average NPR listener is. The average NPR listener is everyone. We have a very wide-ranging audience. We have people who, you know, from rural communities who listen in as they work with their hands, whether it is farming or whether it is, you know, woodworking. We hear all the time from folks who the reason they listen is because they aren't at a computer. They're not on their phone. They're doing things. Truckers, long-haul truckers, another big part of the American economy. You then have people who, yes, are sort of more of the urban, educated, white-collar professionals who are listening as they get ready for work. But the range is really quite large. And I'm always struck by how many people that I meet who said, you know, when I was growing up, I didn't have access to either I grew up in a small town or, you know, there wasn't a great library or, you know, my education had parts that were good, but then, you know, the broader picture of the world around me wasn't as rich, or we didn't have music in my town because there was no entertainment industry. And I found all of that through public media. And so you'll meet people from all over the nation who said, you know, I really grew up on this and it broadened my world. It expanded my curiosity. I learned about science. I learned about politics. I learned about cars, coming back to car talk. I listened to interesting people be interviewed about what motivated them. It inspired me to go be a musician, an actor, you know, a writer, something along these lines. To be a better parent to my children because of listening to the experiences that of other people have had. That is such a powerful thing. And if you think I'm just talking about it, I actually have data too.
So I'm not surprised you do.
Because it is true that our broadcast audience, so that's the radio audience, does tend to skew a little bit more liberal in the way that they identify their political beliefs. If you look at radio across the United States, there's actually quite a lot of conservative talk radio and news radio. And there's not a lot of center or left radio. It doesn't exist. I don't know why that is, but it is the case. And so we find that that audience tends to be a little bit more on one side than the other. In our digital operations where we have great data. Radio, you get information about your audience once a quarter. In digital, where we get information about our audience every single day, I can tell you that it reflects the American public. So about a third of our audience identifies as conservative, about a third of our audience identifies as independent, and about a third of our audience identifies as liberal. So it's actually very representative. And our listening audience matches the population map of the United States. So the biggest listening audience is from the biggest state, California. The second biggest listening audience is from Texas.
Oh, okay. And not just Austin, Texas.
And not just Austin, Texas. No, exactly. So it is a real distribution. And I always think it's important to emphasize that because we can fall into stereotypes, but public media actually brings people together who wouldn't necessarily otherwise be in conversation, to your point about it being a communal experience.
But the other data point that has been discussed at Congress at large, you've been recently to a hearing,
yes,
not the most pleasant setting one finds oneself in, was the question of how is your body of journalists, how is the editorial staff set up, what kind of views do they represent? And there was a lot of talk about the fact that conservative voices are underrepresented or even not represented in your staff. So how can you live up to the expectations of your community that is very diverse politically, while knowing that your editors are mainly politically center or left?
So I know you're referring to a statistic that was published by a former editor of ours in which he surveyed colleagues in the newsroom and came up with a number that said zero Republicans and 80-something Democrats.
87, yeah.
We have 600 people in our newsroom. That is not a representative sample set. And even if you look at that as sort of, even if you look at that and you say, well, but why are there zero Republicans? The answer is often that the newsroom does not tend to register as a particular party. It starts to get into really complicated things about DC governance that are probably not worth getting into, but DC is a supermajority of a Democratic Democratic leadership. So if you even want to vote in a way that is meaningful in a primary, you have to register as a Democrat or you can't vote. Mm. Like, I am a registered independent. I can't vote in the DC primary because it's a Democratic primary.
Yeah, it's closed.
It's closed, right? And so, and because it's always a Democratic mayor and a Democratic council, if you don't vote in the primary, that is the election, right? So some people will say, oh, that's why I've registered. I don't think that's personally, I think journalists should remain independent, but I understand that there's a tension between exercising your rights as a voter and as a citizen. But then you have to also broaden the aperture to say, look, we have 3,000 journalists across the country, and I can guarantee you that they come from a range of different backgrounds and perspectives. They work in every single state across the nation. They are not universally one thing or the other. And that's true of my own newsroom, too. Mm. I know for a fact we have conservatives in the newsroom. They might be social conservatives. They might be fiscal conservatives. They might have a blend of views. No one person are editors, our journalists, our audience can be reduced to a political identity. They are complex people with lots of other things that inform the way they work. But at the end of the day, the thing that should really be what we are judged on is whether the reporting itself is unbiased. And to my mind, what we do in terms of our reporting is not partisan. I know we are accused of bias, but if you listen to the work that we do on our Washington desk about Congress or about the White House, it is really robust political reporting. Where we tend to get more criticism is maybe we're a little too focused on the coast. Maybe we don't have a good understanding of what it means to be from, you know, the panhandle of Texas. I think those are legitimate things for us to be looking at, but that's not the same thing as political bias. It's not liberal bias. It may be that we have blind spots in the way that we reflect the nation. And that's why under my leadership, we've been investing very heavily in partnerships with local stations, in our regional newsrooms, where to cover regions that are undercovered, in collaborating editorially across the various different newsrooms as well. I think that that is how we address some of these issues in a way that is more robust and enduring.
Hmm. Have you also thought about having your programs evaluated scientifically, for instance? I mean, that happens in Swiss media at times, that scientists, scholars, media scholars look at how the reporting is done, etc., so that you can also communicate that better to policymakers.
So for about, I think it was just about 10 years, before I joined NPR, we had a independent ombudsperson for our Middle East coverage. And every year they would issue a report on how was our Middle East coverage balanced. And it's really interesting to go back and read that report, because they look at all different sort of metrics of balance. Did we hear from, you know, an Israeli voice? Did we hear from a Palestinian voice? What percentage of the individual broadcast was one of these individuals or another? How does the overall composition and body of reporting reflect the, you know, balanced perspectives, not just the individual piece that may be responding to breaking news, for example? I think it's a valuable tool to have this kind of insight to understand your own work, for our journalists to be able to say, how are we doing here? Mm. So once a month, our journalists do get together, a rotating group, and evaluate some of the hardest stories we've covered that past month. And then they write up their findings and they publish them publicly.
Okay. So no matter what topic area.
Yeah. We started with the war in Israel and Gaza. And then I think addressed the next one was the protests on campuses in the United States. And it has gone on to cover the election and a variety of different things. I think that's a very healthy practice. We also have a public editor who is independent of our newsroom. She's the ombudsperson for our work. She takes input from the public, assesses and evaluates, reports on our reporters. So from my perspective, we do quite a lot of this work already, and it is part of our mandate and our responsibility as a public media organization.
But how do you get that across to the majority in Congress? Because they don't seem to believe it.
Mm. Well, I've been here for 1 year and I've invested quite a lot in...
And you came at the worst time.
Or the best time, because this is...
Yeah, if you like a challenge.
When it really matters, exactly. And, you know, I am... You mentioned it's a tough situation to go in front of Congress, and it is. You know, it's congressional questioning is tough, regardless of what party the congressperson is a member of. It is also an opportunity to advocate on behalf of our work and explain our work. And I spend a lot of time meeting with members of Congress on the Hill, of meeting with their staff members, talking to them about what we do. But the most effective advocates for what we do are actually local stations, because every member of Congress has a station in their district. Yeah. And those stations can say, yes, of course, this is what we're doing with NPR, and we work with them, and, you know, we collaborate with them, and we are doing this work in the Gulf states or in, you know, Appalachia region, and we're covering issues of health and agriculture that matter. And also, this is what we do independently as a station that matters to our community. That tends to be far more effective than me coming from a national perspective talking about it, because at the end of the day, all politics really are local, and, you know, what your local voters care about is ultimately what's going to influence how you think about approaching an issue.
That's a very good sentiment to end this on, because I think it also carries a hopeful note that since voters care about local news stations and the value that they bring, well, they might also bring the pressure.
Well, I am happy. I'll leave it on another hopeful note. We know that 85% of Americans value local news. Hmm. It is a bipartisan belief that local news is a positive influence on the community. We also know that where local news exists, you have lower rates of partisanship and higher rates of civic participation. So my vote is always to support local news, because it is inherently a civic good. It's part of the civic infrastructure of what brings a country together. And for that and that reason alone, I believe public media should continue to exist for the health of the nation as a whole.
Catherine Marr, it was wonderful to get insight into the complex system that public media is in the United States. For our listeners, what is your favorite NPR show that you think Europeans should give a listen to?
Ooh, gosh, all my children are my favorite.
I will not tell your staff.
I would say that for Europeans at the moment, if you're interested in what's happening in American politics, the Politics Podcast is very good. If you are interested in more sort of American culture, I'm really enjoying Wildcard, which interviews sort of entertainment and cultural figures. And if you love music, there's nothing better than Tiny Desk.
Okay. And I think you should bring Car Talk back.
I miss Car Talk. I really do.
Thank you so much, Catherine. And thank you to all our listeners. We look forward to having you back to our next episode. And until then, I say auf Wiedersehen.
Fritzi Amerika. Views from the Sister Republic. A University of St. Gallen podcast by Claudia Brühwiler.